Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of 8 cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
You're tuned in to The Show on the Road, a new podcast where I interview songwriters, band leaders, and musicians from around the world. My name is Zach Lupitin. This week on the show, my conversation with a restless tuxedoed Texas piano man who has paired his fleet-fingered, high-humored jazz and an Austin Roadhouse keys playing with machete-sharp lyrical turns of phrase and backed it up with his smile through the apocalypse crack country rock band to gain a beloved international following, creating a persona that is half early Billy Joel's tender brilliance and half high-hatted southern huckster who might tell you a story to make you cry one minute or steal your watch when you're not looking the next, Robert Ellis. Let's talk about an instrument that doesn't get enough love or attention on our Roots Americana circuit these days, the piano. Yes, for road dogs like us, it's a cumbersome challenge, forcing a million compromises when you're on the road. There's nothing like the raw power of a real piano, with the wood and cloth and strings sending your sound blasting to the ceiling. And for this first international Across the Pond episode, I was able to catch up with Robert Ellis after his eclectic set at the Ramblin' Roots Fest in Utrecht, Netherlands. And no, he didn't have his preferred baby grand piano with him, but instead was pounding away on a purring Fender Rhodes keyboard on one side and sweating over the keys of a Nord with standard stride piano tone on the front side, the tails of his creamy snake oil salesman tux flying behind him as he went back and forth. And I'll tell you what, I kinda loved seeing him jump around the stage, instrument to instrument, the glitter under his eyes shining like happy tears, the words of his sneaky love songs like passive-aggressive flying into the crowd like shouts from an accidental street preacher, and that kinetic restlessness, that always moving Cheshire Cat grin in the dark, it brings me back to what I heard listening to his newest record, Texas Piano Man, a cocksure, genre-bending, timeless collection of songs that he put out on New West Records, and man, it is unlike anything I've heard in a long time. It puts the piano front and center, as a main character, helping him narrate the stories of fading love and confronting mental illness and the high stress of millennial self-awareness, among other twitchy bugaboos, with both pounding ferocity and surprising tenderness and insight. And let me emphasize, it is almost impossible to tell when this record was put out. The 60s, the 70s, yesterday? Are there lush Beatles-inspired harmonies and mirrored melodic guitar lines? Yes. Mid-70s pop hooks that feel like Harry Nilsson and George Harrison would be teaming up? Yes. But there's also one specific record that this really reminds me of. When I was around 16 and the smoke was still swirling over the fallen Twin Towers, Ben Folds released Rockin' in the Suburbs. He played all the music and all the instruments himself. It continues to be a foundational piece of songwriting and dynamic performance for me. There's a seething, restrained rage in the love songs, a nihilistic, grinning defiance in the stories, and whether Robert realizes it or not, I think he's updated that work. There's a sensibility in his music that acknowledges that we're all a persona in the world. We all put on our own white tux and perform for our peers in our everyday lives. And while Robert was a bit toasted after flying into Holland and having two or four substances keeping him going while we talked, I was struck by his bedrock honesty and his infectious sense of humor. And despite his love of putting on a good show, Playing live is not Robert's favorite thing. There's too much waiting around to get there. Too much temptation to spend all your money and drink and smoke and do your worst every night on these long tours. And he does. And you know what? Robert has admitted to me he doesn't want to be doing this forever. The road has taken a chunk out of his soul and his pride. And the climb to bigger clubs and bigger festivals and bigger notice has been a slow one. But on a rainy day here in Madrid, where I record this right now, I'm glad that an artist like Robert Ellis exists right now. And you know what? I urge you to catch him while you can, because he may not be out there forever. Bright young stars cease being young and bright and can't take it anymore sometimes. And while he's still killing it on the circuit, thank God, the thing I'm most looking forward to is what he comes up with next, because it could be anything. So, without further ado, my Dutch dance with the Texas piano man himself, Robert Ellis.
Nobody smokes anymore. What do I do, man? I'm trying to find a light. Nobody smokes anymore. Everyone else seems to have it all together. They say, buddy, you have to step out. One more drag and I'm out. Such a drag, such a good thing had to end.
No one has. Can you state your name and where we are right now and what you do?
I'm Robert Ellis. We are in Utrecht, Netherlands, and I don't know, I guess I party for a living.
You're the Texas piano man, I hear.
I think so, yeah.
Unfortunately, we couldn't put a grand piano in this little dressing room.
No, and I can't even really, in the States I travel with a real grand.
Yeah.
But I've got a fucking Nord. Can I curse?
Please do.
Okay, cool. I have a Nord that I'm touring with over here, and it's just not as fun.
This is the first international version of the show on the road. Like many American bands, we are crisscrossing the continent right now. And it is amazing, the appetite for like American roots music over here is just fierce.
It's cool. It's bizarre also. I don't know. I find it, I mean, obviously it's good for us that we can tour all these places. There are times where with the music that we make, it's a little frustrating that, I mean, okay, let me just.
They're subdued at times, and you're really rocking out on the keys, and sometimes you can feel that disconnect where you're like, are they feeling this or not? Yeah. And then afterwards, they're so sweet.
Yeah.
You know, what is the disconnect on stage like for you?
It's that. It's also like the. And maybe this is just in my head, but I do think that people who are self-proclaimed fans of a genre tend to have an idea of what that genre should sound like. So, like, because we're from Texas and, and you know, it's called the Texas Piano Man, we often will play on these events where we just frankly don't sound like many of the other bands that are playing there. And especially over here, I find sometimes their expectations are not met.
Right.
You know, so for like, for instance, we played in Switzerland last year at this, the event was called the Country Club. Wow. So it's all these Swiss people in Geneva who...
Not like, golf themed.
No, well, I think it's a play on words, clearly. Yeah. But the whole idea is that they have concerts once a month that are country, where they bring country acts over.
Yeah.
And these are all like hardcore country fans. And we're playing like... I mean, on that tour, we were playing, like, Django tunes and, like...
Oh, wow.
You know, it was not... We did not give them what they wanted. And there was definitely a time, you know, like, everyone was so nice to us and loved us. And then as soon as we played, it was like... It definitely felt like, you guys should get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, well, the thing is that there's so many people right now that are subverting genre and really creating something totally new that hasn't been defined yet, right?
Yeah.
Because you're mixing... sort of almost a jazz sensibility with this sort of Beatles lush pop songwriting.
Thank
you. And you're wearing, you know, a white cowboy hat with a full white suit right now. So it's like, it's hard for people to know what exactly you are.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But it takes a bit to get that across, you know?
Yeah, I think it's better that way, but it also presents its own challenges, you know? It can be frustrating. But yeah, I mean, nothing that any of us are doing is actually new. You know, it's not like we're reinventing music or, you know, like doing something really groundbreaking, but these like combination of elements,
right,
they can be confusing. And I, that was part of the thing with this record though, is like, I think Texas is this really big, lush, just diverse.
It's a wide net.
Yeah, it's a huge place and a huge idea.
Right.
And I don't feel like the idea of Texas is often represented.
Mm.
You know, like, I don't know, there's a, your listeners and you might not even know about it, but there's this huge, huge genre of music called Texas country,
mm-hmm,
that to me sounds a lot like Dave Matthews Band.
Mm.
You know, like, it sounds more like Dave Matthews than it does,
yeah,
you know, Bob Wills or something,
right,
you know?
Right.
But there's just these strange things where, like, people have their own idea of what Texas is. And mm, part of this record was, like, I kind of wanted to say, like, oh, no, Texas, you actually don't know. It's like, mm, it's Donald Judd just as much as it is Larry McMurtry. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, mm, it's, like, weirdo minimalist artists and wacko, like,
especially Austin. I mean, it's like,
yeah, totally, you know, yeah,
you go into Austin, obviously you see the signs, keep Austin weird, and you know,
yeah.
I remember watching Slacker in film school,
yeah,
and just being like, man, I wish I could like go back in time into that weird world.
Yeah,
you know, because it's a unique specimen of a city sort of in an island around a much more conservative,
oh my gosh,
place,
you, yeah, know? It's a refuge for anyone in Texas who can't,
yeah,
do the other. I mean, it's the one little blue dot, you know? Yeah, we're still living in like a very archaic archaic country in many ways.
And you're from southern Texas?
I'm from a really small town south of Houston.
Mm.
Yeah. Super rural, very religious, conservative, you know?
What's it called?
It's called Clute Lake Jackson area. It's Brazoria County, which is actually the biggest county in Texas, but the town that I'm from is just one little piece of it. You know, it's like, it's a shitty little place.
How did your folks end up there?
Well, Dow Chemical Company is how everyone ended up there. Dow Chemical is like
company town.
Yeah, everyone who lives there works at the plant, and my great grandfather, his father moved there for the plant,
mm,
for Dow Chemical Company in the early 20s, maybe. Mm. And my great grandfather's mother and father built a house, and you know, our family's just stayed there forever.
Were you a rebellious child?
Oh, it was horrible. Yeah, it's like, God bless my mom. I mean, like, I was rough. Especially now that I have a child, I'm like, oh fuck, I hope he's nothing like me.
Hey, at what point, yeah, do you see in that little human being like that glint that is from your eye?
He's got it. He's definitely, he's wild. He's like, yeah, he's only a year and a half.
Well, you had to get it from your folks or somewhere down the line, right?
Yeah.
Are you more like your mom or your dad?
I would much rather be more like my mom, but I probably am more like my dad. My dad has had a pretty wild ride, you know, bit of a partier, I think. And
what did he do?
Well, he wasn't really around, you know, where I grew up. I grew up with my mom and I had, you know, my stepfather and stuff. My dad has done all kinds of stuff. Yeah, he's a very smart dude in a lot of ways, you know, very handy. And but yeah, I think he has a little bit of the bug that I have, which is just like kind of push it to the limit. You know, like
the restless spirit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, just like not satisfied, and I don't know. We probably both are a little unstable in some ways, and
yeah. And there's, you know, there's a thread through some of your songs of mental illness and sort of facing it head on.
Yeah,
laughing about it almost in a nihilistic way.
Yeah,
it was like, you know, you open with your, you know, track, I'm fucking crazy, right?
Yeah.
And it's not just I'm crazy, I'm fucking crazy, you know? And that's a very kind of concerted choice to say, like, look, I'm owning this, but it's also, there's the danger lurking behind the smile.
I'm fucking crazy, you know Like this is new. I don't know how to stop myself from acting so insane, screaming like an animal and rattling your cage. You're fucking crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard for years that you should, everybody in the fucking music business is so out of touch and wrong, and I've heard for years that this idea that you need to put like the easiest songs up front.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's what you lead with. That's what your single should be. Your single should be like, which maybe for other bands is fine.
Right.
But what happens with us, it's like a bait and switch. If I put our easiest stuff up front, then people are excited and then let down when they hear the other stuff.
Right.
So I'm like, we should lead with the challenging material and it weeds out people early on.
What do the record labels say about that?
I mean, they did, you know, they asked a couple times, a few different people were like, could you take the word out? Like, what if you just said, I'm crazy. Yeah. And then, the same, like, are you sure that you want that to be the first song?
Yeah.
And I'm like, look, if you...
It's a strong song, though.
I think it's a beautiful song. And if you're going to curse in the name of love is the most noble of causes, you know, like...
It reminds me if Queen had covered Maxwell's Silver Hammer.
Fuck yeah.
But also with Harry Nilsson.
Yeah, sort of it's like got a Nilsson, I mean, Nilsson's Fuck You is, you know, another good example of like, what is he doing? Psycho person.
I also think that it would fit as like a credit song for the movie Joker that just came out.
I haven't seen it yet. Is it really as violent? Have you seen it?
It's not necessarily violent. It's more about sort of mental illness and the sort of falling through the cracks and the system sort of being taken away sort of in the 70s and 80s that would let sort of really hurt psychopathic people into society to do their worst.
Yeah.
I mean, the controversy, I guess, is that it sympathizes with a murderer sort of in a way. But, you know, most people who become murderers, there's a reason why, you know.
Yeah.
And he was abused and blah, blah. I'm not going to spoil it. But,
no.
But there's a certain pleasurable... nihilism, again, I'm coming back to that word about your song, that is about sort of enjoying the madness in some way instead of being shamed by it.
Well, what else? I mean, we don't have much time. What else are we going to do? I mean, like, it's this place is just shit wall to wall, chaos and war and fucking sadness. And if it's not, then you're incredibly lucky. You know what I mean? Like, I'm incredibly lucky that we go around and play music all over the world. What kind of fucking job is this? It's insane. Like, most of the world is horrible and just tragic and chaotic. And I don't know. Yeah, I feel like if you don't see that, then you're naive.
There's a blessing, even though the long drives and the, you know, the sometimes bad audiences, the bad sound can get very toxic, especially as a band member that becomes a family and then you're all sort of breaking down. But it's like, people are giving you money to go in a beautiful hall like we are here in Utrecht, play the songs that you wrote, and then they're going to pay you to eat and drink all you want and hang out for the rest of the night.
It's wonderful.
So it's hard for me, to really lament our lifestyle.
Yeah.
But it's exhausting.
It is.
And that's the part, you know, that we don't talk about, because you can't post about that on Instagram. Like,
I do. I do it in a subversive, sort of funny way. I posted a picture yesterday that said, hey, we're going to Europe for our annual I Hope We Break Even tour. You know, like, which is it's a joke, but it's actually reality. Yeah. Is like, every time we come over here, I either lose money or I break even. And it's just like, I don't know. But all, you know, all that to say, being in a position where things are mostly good, you know, in the scheme of things, like, we have it really good. I feel like the bad things, we have no choice but to laugh at them.
Yeah.
And to, like, I don't know, turn them into something positive. And
what is the first thing that you pack when you leave for a long trip? That's the most important thing.
I have a checklist of stuff that I have to have for the show.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is all pretty important, because if I forget anything in the suit attire thing.
Yeah, the gold chain. Yeah. It just wouldn't be right.
I'm not going to find other boots.
Yeah.
Like white cowboy boots in Denmark.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's probably
you never know, though.
You never know. In Italy, yes.
Yeah.
I usually I take like a few hours and I put all my stuff out and I do sort of a manic pack where I just throw shit in there and go around the house looking. I'm like, oh, I need my square reader. I need my, you know, I'm in Europe, so I need to go. I have a stash of different currencies, and every country that I get into, I take it out of my little safe box.
Well, I thought when you were saying stash, you were going to say something else.
But no, okay. I don't fly with drugs often. you can, actually, surprisingly easy.
I've been surprised at how many people, even in my own band, are doing that.
It's surprisingly easy. They're not looking for drugs. They're looking for bombs. They want,
Yeah.
They're. I mean, they're. I think the dogs that are there even are like bomb dogs. They're not drug dogs.
What's your number one vice? Alcohol?
Alcohol, for sure. Alcohol, yeah. Tobacco, I guess. Also, I pretty consistently have a snus in.
It's very Texas of you.
Yeah. I used to dip, but you can't, you know, spitting is not acceptable in other places, you know, like...
Doesn't affect your voice?
The snus? No, smoking did really bad. Smoking was like, would ruin my voice.
Yeah.
And I had some cigarettes last night, and I woke up this morning like, oh, part of my range is missing.
It amazes me when you see all those old pictures. It's like Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. Everyone's smoking like a chimney. And you're like, how did you sound that good? And everyone's chain smoking for 40 years.
Yeah. I don't understand it. I mean, we played with Emmylou in New York not that long ago. And we're all backstage. And yeah, she's just fucking housing cigarettes.
Emmylou is?
Yeah, just like...
With that high
angel voice. Yeah, her voice, she sounds like an angel. She sounded so good that night.
Yeah.
You know, I have one, and I feel like I've lost most of my range, you know?
Is there a really weird venue that you can remember playing that stuck with you?
Many. Weird? I don't know. There's...
Dangerous?
Dangerous.
Frightening?
I mean, I think the most dangerous gig we've ever done is probably the... Bandidos International Motorcycle Rally.
Okay.
So that was maybe the... our shows in Houston forever, we did these weekly gigs in Houston. We played a bunch of country music and a bunch of my friends...
Fitzgerald's?
Yeah, Fitzgerald's. And a bunch of my friends were in the Bandidos. And they would come out to the shows every week and party with us and hang out. And
it's a biker gang?
It's... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what you are supposed to call it—an organization. They're a biker organization,
fraternity.
Yeah, of some sort. You could do a quick Google search and find out more about them. I mean, they are like—I think they're the biggest in the country.
You know, wow!
The Hells Angels are famous.
Yeah,
you know, but the Bandidos are—it's a huge organization. And they asked us to play their yearly, like. Every bandito from across the country comes to this one rally.
Hmm.
And yeah, that was really interesting. Because my friends who were in the organization, they were like, when you get there, heads up, you're going to park the van, and then each of the members of your band are going to have a prospect who's like someone who is, you know, going to be in the organization. They're like petitioning to be a bandito or whatever.
Yeah.
You're each going to have a prospect assigned to you as a security. So my friend was like, whatever you do, if you go to the fucking bathroom, if you go to the car, you go have a cigarette, bring the prospect with
you.
Why
is it so dangerous?
I don't know, but it was just, they were adamant about like, anywhere you go on these grounds, bring the prospect.
Yeah.
And he has a, you know, he's like got credentials or whatever,
right.
And he'll vouch for you that you belong here.
Right.
You know, so that was very cool. It was a great gig. And they're wonderful people. They were so nice to us.
No like knifings happened.
No. Surprisingly tame, you know, but I was like, oh, I need security. This is probably.
Yeah. It was like my grandfather used to work as a engineer, but as one of the lead civilian people in the government, like in the Defense Department.
Whoa, cool.
In, you know, sort of like space stuff and
also
government.
Did you live in D.C.? Did you grow up in
D.C.? I didn't, but my mom did. And So he got honored with this thing called the Fubini Award, which was like the highest civilian sort of honor. It was like this big like bust with like a medal and stuff. And we go into the Pentagon for this sort of celebration in like one of the conference rooms.
That's the coolest thing I've ever heard.
And they had, I was like, I'm just going to go to the bathroom. And the security guy's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, I will go to the bathroom with you.
Yeah, you're in the Pentagon.
Yeah, I was like, I was like wandering. I'm like, oh, there's Dick Cheney's office. Yeah. You know? And yeah. I like wandered down there and he kind of like watched me take a leak.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they're like, we're not going
to let. He's like trying not to look. He's like, yeah. Like kind of looking real official about it.
We're not going
to
let you Fox Mulder this situation. Yeah. You're sending someone with you. You're not going to just go wander around.
My grandfather was kind of like, you know, he was like in a wheelchair and kind of getting a little, he had some dementia yeah. type things. Still very sharp. He had this sense of humor where he looked around the room, you know, and he hadn't worked there since like, you know, he was there under McNamara, like the Johnson
Whoa,
administration, you know.
Crazy.
So he goes, well, I'm glad they finally have some women in here.
Wow.
That was the only thing
That's
he said.
Awesome. What a fucking
They were like
guy.
Waiting for a speech and he kind of like paused and was like, good to see some broads in the
that
house.
That rules. What a cool dude. he was there in the craziest oh, era. Yeah. Like that was like.
No, I wish he was still around because there's stories that I think he couldn't actually tell.
Yeah.
That I kind of would try to get out of him, you know?
There's been some stuff recently about that administration that's come out that you're like, whoa. It kind of makes, I mean, I generally think the conservative conspiracy theory mindset is flawed. Like,
right.
Usually the simplest solution is actually the true one.
Right.
And some of these crazy government conspiracy things, I'm like, no fucking way. You know how complicated that would be?
Yeah.
You know, but hearing stuff about that era and yeah. that administration from people that were involved, you're like, wait a minute, this was actually like, you guys did some fucked up insane shit.
The only thing he like actually told me that really stuck with me was he said that when he was under McNamara during the Cold War, he was partially in charge of calculating mega death scenarios.
Wow. Of course they have to have contingencies.
If the Russians bombed yeah. San Francisco, Seattle, LA, San Diego,
wow.
we would then respond by
yeah,
doing
course,
this
yeah.
and it would kill this many people.
Yeah, and they have a plan for every, they have to.
It's like, that's what you did and
so
work?
Crazy. What do you think about aliens? You think we've found any, you think there's aliens?
Not really.
Yeah.
I really want there to be.
I mean, I'm with you. I don't think that their aliens have visited us and that we're covering it up or some shit. You know, I don't believe the Roswell Area 51 thing.
Yeah.
That's too, again, it's too complicated. It would just be like such a massive cover-up.
Yeah.
But I do think with how big the universe is, it would be remarkable if there wasn't other life.
Oh, statistically, it's impossible
yeah.
if there's not other
there's
life.
There's gotta be.
I think that they're probably either indifferent to us or they're just like, they're so far away, they're like, we have no idea if there's anyone out there either.
Or we're the most advanced. Even though that's highly unlikely,
yeah.
it's possible that if there is other life, they aren't even, you know, maybe they're equally advanced as us
yeah.
or not as, you know, like they just haven't made contact, just like we couldn't.
Yeah.
We can't go very far at all. Can't even fucking get to Mars.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
if you were to be booked for the first festival on Mars.
Yes. Yes, I would do
You
it.
Know it's a matter of time. It's a matter of time.
Yes, in a heartbeat.
Live Nation, live on Mars.
Heart, yeah, yeah, totally.
What would the first three songs in your set be?
Life on Mars.
Okay.
David Bowie. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'd have to play my material, right? So,
ideally, yeah. I don't know. Getting yeah. a piano up there might be hard.
That's but. True, yeah. I don't know if there's a good backline company on Mars.
It'd be a good business to get
yeah,
in.
Yeah, that's what we should do. I've often said, and I really do stand by this, if they told me that I could go in a spaceship, go out into space, and they said, look, there's a 50% chance, we've calculated the odds, there's a 50% chance you'll die. You'll never come back. Maybe now that I have a kid, it's a little different. For years, I would have said, yes, I'll go in a heartbeat. Like the idea.
Because it would be a badass way to die.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
Be like, well, yeah. you know, he didn't make it back, but he really went out in a flame of glory.
Yeah, seeing the Earth from space just seems. I went to NASA. So I have one of my other suits is like this custom-made suit by this guy, Jerry Atwood's Union Western Company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all NASA-themed. So it has mm-hmm. rockets on it, and it has a bunch of just all NASA. It's like a nudie suit.
Yeah.
It's a tribute to NASA. And I've been wearing it for years, and someone at NASA at some point reached out to me, got my email, and said, "Hey, I'm a big fan of your music. Would you like to come do a private tour of NASA?"
Oh, shit.
And so me and my band all went and took like the backstage, behind the scenes, crazy tour.
What does this button do? Oh, shit.
It was the craziest day of my life. When we were at Mission Control, and they put my picture up on Mission Control.
In Houston?
Yeah, when we walked in.
Yeah.
And it said, like, "Welcome, Robert Ellis." And we're watching the fucking Japanese astronaut on the International Space Station in real time.
Oh, shit.
He can see us. We can see him. Like, the smartest people on the planet are all, you know, like, it was the craziest day. And then we went to the Neutral Buoyancy Lab where they train, which is like a 10 football field sized pool where they have a replica of the space station underwater,
because
they all train the only way to train for anti-gravity is underwater still. It's the best way to do it. I did, just the whole thing was a crazy day. I met two astronauts who have both been to the space station, you know, handful of times, and I just was like a child. I was so geeked out, you know, like.
Who was the last person you met that made you like super starstruck?
I mean, I played with Rufus Wainwright a few days ago, and that was pretty rough on me.
Cigarettes and chocolate, man.
I love him so much. Like,
that album is just like transcendent.
He's in my top five artists of all time.
Hmm.
And he was absolutely pleasant and wonderful and a nice person, and the shows were great. But I was pretty nervous to do the shows. I mean, like, I could give a fuck about a lot of the people that I meet through this job. It's just not usually the kind of music I listen to.
Right.
But yeah, somebody like Rufus, or one time I was in Belgium and I met Randy Newman. We played the same venue, the AB Club in Brussels. Do you know that place?
No.
It's a cool little club in Brussels, but there's two rooms, smaller room and a bigger room. They're like bringing in the grand piano in the morning while we're loading in. I was like, "Oh, they're tuning this grand piano. I wonder who's playing here." And just happened that Randy Newman's tour, I was on tour with Dawes. And so me and Dawes were in the same building as Randy Newman. And through like a mutual friend, I sent some emails and I got to go talk to him after the show and meet him backstage. And I was just like, "Mr. Newman, I'm a huge fan. I just couldn't, you know, like, I have nothing to say." You know, I was like, "Why did I want to meet you?"
Yeah, it's funny because I totally didn't think of how much the parallels are there between you guys, you know.
He's one of my biggest heroes, for sure.
Because there's the sort of humor and the sort of biting commentary that you guys both have. You know, going back to that song, "Nobody Smokes Anymore," it's like the sort of satirizing our self-awareness as a you know, a millennial culture or whatever, like how everyone is trying to be so sort of healthy and woke, but also we're so stressed out and so sort of constantly angry and freaking out that it's like, how much of all this is worth it, you know? And it made me think of, like, you know, we're traveling in Europe right now. The thing I still don't get about Europe, because they're so far ahead of us in so many things, but everyone is still smoking.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And I'm like, how did you not get that part of it?
Yeah.
And yet also, how is it not affecting their lifespan?
Yeah,
it is. But they're less stressed out, though.
Yeah, who knows? I mean,
you know?
But that song also, from like a meta, I don't know, like many of those songs are kind of from a character's perspective.
Yeah.
And I definitely, I feel that way. Like, I'm like, oh, I like to have a lot of fun, and I don't think you should be stressed. And but I also, there's stuff in there that is totally not me. Like, I don't know. I think there are lines in that song that people could take to mean like, this whole PC culture is bogus,
right, you know.
And there's definitely, like, when I was writing it, I put stuff in there that kind of sounds like that, and that's not the way I feel. I actually am, you know, pretty, I think that a lot of what's happening right now is really good.
Yeah.
And I think it's like really necessary, and I'm not actually bummed about, I don't know. I just would never want anyone to listen to that song and be like, well, fuck yeah, I agree. This Me Too thing is out of control. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, because I do think some of those lyrics sort of, I've had people come up to me and tell me like that that's what they took from it. And yeah, I just, that's not how I feel. I'm pretty, I guess I'm pretty normal, liberal, progressive dude in a lot of ways. I don't know. I feel like good art is not about giving somebody answers. It's about giving people more questions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the whole fucking point. So, yeah, that sort of stuff where, like, just because things are, I don't know. I hear a lot of stuff on the radio that, like, the song is called, like, I'm Leaving.
Yeah.
Things are bad. I'm leaving.
Hmm.
What is the fucking story? Yeah. Like, what is that story? That's not a story. That's
like,
not
if this was a movie, I wouldn't go see
it. Yeah, no, it'd be over. It'd be instantly over. Yeah, there's, like, nothing about it that's, like, interesting. It's not gray.
Well, I think that people don't maybe view music or songwriting in the same way as fiction and narrative writing in the way that, like, well, I don't have to have a punchline or a twist ending or blah, blah. It's like, yeah, but the best songs often...
Yeah.
Have that full arc, like it's a play or a movie.
It's,
you know,
3 minutes. Like, I'm bored after 30 seconds. You know, like, you really gotta, I don't know. It's, songwriting is complicated. That's a big reason. I mean, if you want to cite some really simple big hits as an example, you know, great songs like Willie Nelson songs. There are some really beautiful songs that he wrote that are just pure love songs.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back and look at how long they are, often they're like a minute and 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Because you did it. He did the verse. He did the chorus. He did the chorus again. Song's over. Because, what I mean, what are you going to say with the second verse?
Yeah.
What new light are you going to cast on, you know, like, it's like, I don't know.
Tell me about the song Passive Aggressive.
Yeah.
Which I watched tonight in this venue in Utrecht, and there's these sort of jumps in and out of time.
Yeah.
Sort of almost like a jazz trio, like, it's testing the limits of time. And I fucking loved it.
Thank
and I
you.
Could see the audience sort of being like, what the fuck is happening here?
It's rhythmically passive aggressive.
Yeah.
The whole point of the arrangement was like to try and make the song sound passive aggressive.
Yeah.
So like there's a lot of times, especially live, where we've been playing the same melody over and over, and then when you really expect it to happen again, we don't play it.
Yeah.
Or you know what I mean? It just, we stop like on the breath or whatever, and things to, there's a couple jumped bars and like...
I mean, most of the words of the song are just
there's only
aggressive,
there's only 10 words to the whole song. That's kind of what I'm
can
saying.
Can you slam poetry style it?
Yeah, sure. The words of the song are really simple. It just goes, tell me what you're mad about. Go ahead, let it all out. Go on ahead and say something you cannot take back, or bottle it all up inside. Out in the open is no place to hide. Please just pull over and let me get out of the car. And then I ask you what's wrong, you say nothing. But you look like you're about to explode.
Passive aggressive,
over and over. Like, it just never stops. Yeah.
Passive aggressive. You're so passive aggressive.
But I think like that is one of those things where we actually like, all right, we get to the point.
Yeah.
And then the point is made.
Yeah.
You know?
I get bored by the end of that song because I'm like, I just said the same words fucking over and over for a minute and a half. You know?
But that's it was always funny when you listen to like hits that you've heard your whole life, like Benny and the Jets.
Yeah.
3/4 of that song is just
Benny.
Going, Benny,
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 yeah, Benny, and it's this hypnotic sort of like, and I don't even like that song, and I can't ever get that song out of my head sometimes, you know?
I had a band with my good friend James Love, a Houston guy.
Yeah.
He played guitar in that band Dillinger Escape Plan,
mm-hmm.
and he had a really amazing band called Golden Axe. He's just one of the fucking best musicians on the planet. But we had a stupid band. We had one practice.
Uh-huh.
We had a show booked, but we couldn't get through the practice because it was too funny.
Yeah.
The band was called Broken Record,
uh-huh.
and we played Benny and the Jets,
mm-hmm.
but we just did Benny, 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 Benny.
You never got to the Jets.
Benny! We did it for 3.5 minutes. Benny!
Oh my God.
And then we did the Ace of Spades! The Ace of Spades! The Ace of Spades! The Broken Record is the name of the band. And then we did a Born in the USA, I was born in the USA.
Oh, are there recordings of this?
Yeah, we made some demos of it. It was so funny. We were on the floor. Because after you do Born in the USA for 2.5 minutes, your brain feels like it's going to explode.
Like, it reminds me of that. What was that story of the guy who went into the diner somewhere and just played What's New Pussycat 120 times in a row in the jukebox just to see if anyone would like... And, like, the first 12 times, no one even noticed. They're just eating their sandwiches. And then, like, 13 or 14 times in a row, people started getting, like, confused and angry.
Yeah.
And then they were, like, literally trying to tear the jukebox out of the wall.
Doesn't work like that anymore.
Yeah.
Not with touch tunes. No. Somebody will jump you. And sometimes the jukebox will do unpredictable things and just play random songs. I'll load shit into that touch tunes thing all the time.
If you could write the score... my question:
how's this going? Is the interview going well?
I'm loving every moment of it. What do you wish you could tell yourself as a young man? You now, as a wise, white suit wearing sage.
If, in all actuality, I wish I could tell myself to do all of the things that you have a feeling about doing, like calling your mom or fucking, you know, like going to see your grandmother or like those things when you're on the road as a young man.
Yeah.
I feel like you have these feelings often. You're like, you know what? I should write a postcard. I should, I should, but I think that, I don't know, when you're young, you feel like you have a lot of time and you feel like these tours are going to be over. I'll go visit. Some, you know what I mean? Like,
you lost your mom pretty young.
Yeah, I lost her last year. She was like 52 or maybe a little older, but very young. And it's like, yeah, this touring lifestyle is like you have to compartmentalize your life so hard.
Yeah.
And now I'm dealing with it with the kid, and I feel like I'm being better about it. But when you're on the road, you're just like, oh, I'm here. I'm doing this. And everything else will just be on pause and everyone will understand.
Yeah.
But I'm just realizing more and more, like, you... There's only so much that your friends will allow you to be absent. You know, like, there's only so much that you can just be, like, the fun guy that's always gone.
Right.
You still have to call people. You have to check in. You know what I mean? You have to be a part of their life. I don't know. I think that that's my biggest regret over this whole thing. It's just, like... I feel like 10 years went by where I was just gone, you know, and just so much happened.
Yeah. And you know, you lose certain friendships and you went through a divorce, right?
Yeah, that was definitely, I mean, we weren't meant to be together, but it was also a product of all the touring and, you know, distance. And there are different types of distance. It's not just like being away from somebody necessarily means that you grow apart. I think that also you make choices, like, I don't know, we do with my partner now, we like, we email each other every day, like a real effort to communicate, you know, and then we also keep, we each keep a journal when we're apart from each other, where we each write in the journal to each other, and then when we get together, we trade journals and we read all the notes. So like, even though we can't talk every day, because this is insane, and like, we're in a fucking basement right now, I haven't had service all day.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really text, we don't really talk on the phone, we do emails and we do the journal. And because of that, I think we stay connected. I don't know.
That's a good, that's a good idea.
My therapist thought it was a really great idea. She couldn't believe it. When I told her that we've been doing that our whole relationship, she's like, I'm going to suggest this to be, she's like, this is such a good thing that... But, like, it started, I was in Amsterdam, actually, and I picked up this really cool little paper journal, and I brought it home as a gift to Erica, and then I think she was like, we should write in this to each other, you know, and then, like, while we're gone, we have this thing to read where every day we were thinking, you know, all of it is just to let someone know that you're there.
Yeah.
You're not, you know, you're thinking about them. Mm-hmm. If you get home from a tour and it's like, oh, for at least half an hour a day, mm-hmm. you thought about me, you fucking wrote to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It kind of means a lot. You weren't just out getting wasted and mm-hmm. doing God knows what, you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's a persona that you put on? Obviously, you know, in your,
your hat and glitter. That's a funny question.
But, like, do you have to, like, literally get that skin on right as you walk on stage, or is it like a method acting thing?
I mean, it's a part of me for sure. Like, I mean, like, the character of the Texas Piano Man is just kind of a wild, fun entertainer, mm-hmm. and it's definitely me. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like it's based on aspects of my personality, but putting on the suit and putting on the whole thing, and like mm-hmm. it definitely gets me into the mindset of, okay, now I'm going on stage. Mm. I need to perform. It's kind of what you were talking about earlier, is like, for me, it's a little less about how I look, you know, even though it does look fucking cool. It's more about like, if I want to do this job and really entertain people and be a good performer,
right,
it just gets me into the mindset.
Yeah.
You know, I put on the outfit and then I'm like, okay, I've got, like, I look in the mirror and I've got glitter and the tuxedo on, and even if I feel horrible, mm-hmm. I'm like, it's go time. I need to, mm-hmm. I'm this now. I'm mm-hmm. this guy. And he's actually not hungover. He's not jaded. Mm-hmm. He's not bummed about touring. He's just psyched to perform. You know, like, that's, it's like all of the best aspects of my personality. Mm-hmm. I wanted to create a character that just embodied that. And
well, I think we forget that, like, the theatricalness of performing is not limited to just being in a Shakespeare show or a Broadway musical. It's like, we are doing a little bit of everything as, you know, musical performers, where we have to tell these dense lyrical stories.
Yeah.
We have this music that's lifting it up, but also we're inhabiting those stories in front of this audience and they can tell if you're bullshitting.
Totally.
You know?
And regardless of what anyone thinks they're doing up there, if you have jeans and a t-shirt on, you're still playing a character.
Yeah.
No matter what. Like, when people, this idea that, like, you're just going up there as you, in mm-hmm. quotations, there's no such thing. Mm-hmm. You have 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour and a half on stage. You have a short amount of time. Humans are very complex, complicated people. And in an hour and a half, there's no way you can be your whole self. Mm-hmm. You have to choose which aspects of yourself you're going to share. So this idea of authenticity, like, I'm going to get up there and just be myself, no one is that. If you were yourself, you would be some shows horrible and some shows really grumpy. Some shows you would cry and you'd be really sad for no reason. You know what I mean? Like, you choose when you get up there, you're like, I'm going to be myself, but I'm going to be aspects of myself that I want to share in an hour and a half as much as I can. And I think that, you know, there's an aversion to, like, performance, and I feel like often people are like, oh, cool, it's cool that you're doing this white tuxedo thing. We just go up in our regular clothes and we're just ourselves. I'm like, that's bullshit. No one is. You know, like, you're playing the casual character.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's all it is. It's like, we're all making a choice. I just happen to have chosen a white tuxedo.
Whatever gets you in the game.
You know? Yeah. It gets me excited. Yeah.
All right. Since you had your first night on this European tour in Amsterdam that went late and got crazy, perhaps.
I partied a lot last night. I think
the fitting thing is to do a reading at random from the book I found on this tour, A Short History of Drunkenness, by Mark Forsyth.
This seems like a... Who wanted Prohibition? That, to me, that's all I should read, actually. Who wanted Prohibition? That's the name of a chapter. Who wanted Prohibition? The Prohibition movement wasn't conservative. It was feminist. It was also progressive. In something like the proper sense of the word, it was meant to help a nation reform and progress to a new and previously unheard of state of sobriety. It was also Midwestern. All surprising. Finally, the Prohibition movement was also, this one is the most surprising, not against alcohol. It was against the saloon. Mm. There was a popular perception throughout the West that husbands would get paid, go to the saloon, spend it all, and return home penniless and angry. Sounds right, actually. Where they would beat their wives. probably also right. The wives lived in bruised poverty because the saloons took all the money. Nobody knows to what extent this is true. Domestic violence is a notoriously difficult crime to get figures on while it's happening. Blah, 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 blah. What's important for our purposes is that people believed that this is what was happening. People wrote plays and novels about it, 10 Nights in a Bar Room. What I saw there was the second best-selling American novel after Uncle Tom's Cabin, and both indirectly brought about amendments to the Constitution. Wow. This is very interesting. I like this
book. It is a good book.
Yeah.
My question from this would be, do you think that you are a person that responds to hard rules? Like, do you think you could not drink for a month?
I do
to
that.
Better your mental
I do that
health.
Often, yeah. I mean, like, I'm a man of extremes, so I either
it's hard for me to do anything that's like all or nothing. It like freaks me out for some reason.
Wow, I'm the opposite. I only do all or nothing. I
that seems to be the way it is. It's like there's like a personality distinction between people who can like go all out. They drink till 4 a.m, or they just don't drink for 2 months.
That's what I do. That's exactly what I do. Every year, I take a certain amount of time off.
Yeah.
I just took a month off, like 2 months ago, I think. I might have made it 3 weeks. I don't know. Or maybe I didn't do a full month. But I just can't drink casually.
Yeah.
I can't do drugs casually. I can't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I just fucking go full force.
Yeah.
I try and push it to the actual limit. Or I don't do it at all. And sobriety becomes a thing that I'm like, competitive about, where I'm like, you know, it's been fucking 28 days, you know, like in my head I'm like,
but is there a point where you've gone too far and you've had to sort of reckon with yourself?
Oh, definitely. I was sober for 9 months one time. It was horrible. Oh, you meant the other.
What brought that on? Something brought that on.
Well, I know, I got in a weird, I was like, oh, I should be sober for a while. I got a divorce and I was like, I want to clear my head and see what it's like. And I made it 9 months, and I'm sure my body thanked me. But yeah, I mean, it was just like slipping into an old familiar jacket. You know, like I was on this fucking cruise, and one night I was like, you know what, I think I'm going to have a glass of wine. Had a glass of wine, boom, I had a bottle of wine. I was in the casino gambling, stayed up all night, you know, like just went nuts. And then since then, it's just like, I'm in, you know?
Do songs pour out of you in spurts like that?
Mm-hmm.
And then is there a drought?
Yeah, but it's not for any reason. I wouldn't ever say, you know, if you have time and you're a serious songwriter, you can always write songs.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have time. I'm like touring and I'm fucking raising a kid and it's just like, and I'm okay with that. I compartmentalize songwriting in this way where I'm like, I don't write when I'm not writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm
so
not,
you actually sit down and be like, I'm going to write a song today.
Yeah, I show up at the office. Like, when I want to write.
Do you have an office that you do it in?
Yeah, I have a piano. I have a piano in every room at the house. I'm
like,
yeah, it's like a real problem, actually. I like have a bunch of spaces. And I just have to be really selective. Like, even with writing, I love writing music, but there are goals that I want to achieve that are not.
Mm.
Like, I want to be a better piano player.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm home, I was home for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
I practice for a couple hours a day doing, like, piano stuff.
Mm.
I'm sure that's time I could have spent writing, but I prioritize. And when
that's
I'm on
smart.
The road, you know, I can't really
Are you
practice.
Self-taught?
My mother was a piano teacher.
Oh.
Yeah, so I grew up playing. But yeah, I mean, in a short time, when all of this touring is over and things are slowing down a little bit, I'll take 2 months and I'll just write every day, you know? And then at the end of it, maybe I'll have 30 songs or something and I'll start narrowing down what I want to put on an album, or I'll keep writing. Who knows? But like, I go in spurts. Yeah.
Have you written a song for your son?
Not yet. No. I haven't written a song since my son was, you know, I really haven't written one song in fucking a year. I mean, I have for like, other people will come and write with me and I'll, you know, like co-write and stuff like that. But like real writing, you know, the stuff that I want to put on a record, I haven't written one song.
If you could co-write with anyone in the world right now, who would it be?
That's a hard one because co-writing is so tough. Like, I kind of hate it most of the time.
Yeah.
Even people I really like.
Yeah.
You know, like fucking kind of sucks sometimes. I would love to write with Randy Newman.
Hmm.
I'd love to write with Rufus. I think it'd be really cool to write with an author I really liked, you know?
Hmm.
Like George Saunders.
Hmm.
Saunders or Murakami.
Hmm.
That would be fucking cool, Hang. To write with Murakami and be like, what do you think a song should be about?
Yeah.
You know, like, he'd probably have a really cool idea.
That would be... You know what I wish that would still happen is, like, back in, like, the 60s, you would see those lineups, like, at the Fillmore where it'd be, like, Lenny Bruce and Jefferson Airplane.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. Like, these completely different art forms that were sort of intertwined in a natural way.
Yeah.
You know, like, why don't we have like poets and
yeah.
like dancers and acrobats and then also Robert Ellis?
Because we can barely do music.
Because they only have $500.
Yeah, there's only $500 to go around.
Break Even Tour 2019.
We're barely making music happen. So.
Do you think your son is aware of what you do?
He loves music. Yeah. He's got a cool life. I'm like... I think a lot of people have kids and they insulate themselves.
Mm.
You know, you go, oh, I have a kid now. My life is different.
Mm-hmm.
We've done the opposite. My wife's a filmmaker.
Mm.
She's an artist and a writer. And, I don't know. I just had this feeling when she got pregnant of like, this is the life I've been working so hard to create this life.
Yeah.
To have artistic friends and all these people around and like this life of art and music.
Mm-hmm.
Now is when it is actually meaningful. Now I can share it with someone.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, why would I fucking shut myself up in my house and stop going out to concerts and art shows and, you know, hanging with interesting people and having interesting conversation? Like, he's actually the reason that I did all this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's amazing. Yeah. It's
what is the goal? What is, like, the dream goal?
I mean, my goal is to stop. If I could get to a place where I was successful enough to stop, that would be the goal.
Stop, like, where you can just, like, make a record and
hang out. Stop touring. Like, and I just,
And just play out every now and again.
Yeah, I don't like this shit. Honestly.
Do you not feel like you're more of a introvert than an extrovert?
I like writing.
You're an entertainer, though.
Yeah, I mean, I like playing, too. I just don't like, it's just a time suck. It's just what we're talking about. Like, I want to be writing music. I want to be at home working. You know what I mean? I just have no fucking time.
That is interesting. Yeah, it's like being on the road does sort of slash the creativity. There is ways to stay creative out here, but you do sort of like forget that you can still be creative sometimes because you're like, you're going to like the factory.
Yeah.
Like you're checking in, you're going to soundcheck, you're going back to the hotel, having dinner. Start again and again and again, the same thing every day.
It's kind of lost time, yeah. I don't know. I do like performing, but that's only 45 minutes out of the day. I mean, that's like, the ratio is unbelievable.
What keeps the joy?
The 45 minutes. I mean, that's the only reason you do any of it.
Yeah.
But it is like, you know, the traveling aspect of it. It's like, it's a lot of work for very little money. But it's the money that you need to support your family. Like, you have to. It's the only source of revenue, so you have to tour. But yeah, I could imagine a future where I'm in a studio working every day, writing, you know, like that sounds really nice. Or like what Rufus does now, where he's like took the whole summer off in Montauk and practices piano and just like hangs out with his kid. You know, like that sounds fucking awesome. And maybe I haven't earned it yet. you know, like, but
it sounds pretty dreamy.
Yeah, it sounds really nice.
All right. So we're going to take us out, with a song that you would like to introduce of yours.
Oh, sure. What should we...
Which song would you like to introduce people to?
I don't know. You should pick one. I don't care. Pick a song. Just pick a song and play it. Any of the songs are good.
I mean, Topo Chico and Lime puts a smile on my face.
I love that song.
But I kind of want the Aren't We Supposed to Be
In Love. Yeah, play that one. Yeah.
Because I think... It really cuts to the heart of
the
point in every love affair that no one talks about.
Cool. I love it. I love that song.
All right, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. I don't want to fight. Lately we do it every night. I don't know why. Aren't we supposed to be? To make
just haven't done it in a while. I don't know why. Aren't we supposed to be in love? Tell me why you get so angry over the littlest things. Tell me why it's hard to look you in the eye. Tell me what has happened to the kindness. You don't treat me like a lover or a friend. Help me, I just don't understand this. Tell me why. Supposed to be in love. Well, it makes me so afraid how you can feel this far away. No reason why when we're supposed to be in love. Well, maybe it's a phase, but I can't go on this way. No reason why aren't we supposed to be. Like a matter of time. And tell me what has happened to the kindness. You don't treat me like a lover or a friend. Help me, I just don't understand this. Tell me why. Aren't we supposed to be? Aren't we supposed to be? Aren't we supposed to be? And talking about how lucky we are, we are, we are. I wanna go back to the beginning. All I wanna know is how we came this far. Tell me what has happened to the kindness. You don't treat me like a lover or a friend. Help me, I just don't understand this. Tell me what has happened to the softness. And tell me how to get it back again. Help me, I just don't understand this. Tell me why. Aren't we supposed to be? Aren't we supposed to be? Aren't we supposed to be?
Big thanks to Robert Ellis and his team for setting up the talk we had in Utrecht, Netherlands. You can go to texaspianoman.com or robertellismusic.com for his tour dates and his new record. And to support that lovely record, he will be crisscrossing throughout Europe all this month and then returning home to Texas, playing at Stubbs Barbecue November 16th, playing a Christmas show in Houston on December 8th, and on and on. Please check him out. He is wonderful live. And if you go to thebluegrasssituation.com, there's a wonderful article called Harmonic Convergence, talking to Robert Ellis and Courtney Harmon, the amazing guitar player, singer, who used to be in Delamay. And you know what? I'm going to put this out into the universe. I think Dust Bowl Revival and Robert Ellis should tour together in 2020. I think it would be pretty dreamy. And you know what is also coming in 2020? Dust Bowl Revival's new album will be coming out. Huge announcement in a few days. If you are on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, look out for the first single of the new album. It's going to be really exciting. And you know what? If you go on our Instagram, Dust Bowl Revival, there's a semi-naked shower scene revealing some new surprises. You should go check it out. I record this right now from a tiny hotel room in Madrid, Spain. We are starting our very first run here and going all the way up from Madrid to Asturias and to Galicia and then heading over to the United Kingdom to finish out our run. I've been gone from home so long, I hope my wife is still there when I get home. You can go to dustbowlrevival.com for the music and tour dates that we have coming up, and we'll be coming to Cincinnati and throughout Ohio and Rochester, New York, and Woodstock, New York in mid-November, so look out for that too.
The show on the road is hosted by me, Zach Lupitan, and produced by the handsome Hawaiian Chris Jacobs with support from the Bluegrass Situation team. If you love the show on the road, please leave us a review or rating over at itunes.com/showontheroad. Tell your friends, and also be sure to check out BGS's ever-growing collection of podcasts up right now on the bluegrasssituation.com. The show on the road is a part of the BGS Podcast Network. This is Zach Lupitan. See you on the trail.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app
and subscribe now.